So we were doing, so the long story has been, we've done a bunch of things that are kind of special cases of first principles, quantum field theory, where it's relativistic, using QED as the example, and now we're kind of switching over to calculating things. The last class, I think, was the Feynman rules. And before we started evaluating a couple graphs, I wanted to come back to, we have this, the Feynman rules, let me just write them down. Remember, so we have, external lines. So if you have some sort of a process where we're calculating the some transition matrix element of some time-ordered product of some operators, and this is the I guess since I'm not writing the interaction Hamiltonian stuff here, this is a this would be the out vacuum, and this is the in vacuum. This is the thing that we know either through Lowe's theorem, which is one of the things you're proving in the assignment, how to write that in terms of perturbation theory and the interaction picture, and that involves matrix elements of free between free states of a bunch of operators that are either the operators we're given or things in the interaction Lagrangian. So we have L is some free thing plus an interaction thing, and we're perturbating in that, and then the evaluation of the matrix element is always coming down to evaluation of creation annihilation operator matrix elements in the vacuum. And then that's a matter of pairing off whoever gets created has to get destroyed, pairing it off in all different ways. And that's the combinatorics of that is well described graphically, and the Feynman rules just express that. So you have some sort of a process where, so let's say we have things like that, here the straight lines are meant to, we've got wavy lines and straight lines, and the wavy lines are the photons, and the straight lines are the electrons. The arrow is telling you the direction of the fermion number flow. And then external lines corresponded to things that were in these states, and there was the Feynman rule for them was just the piece of the field that, any kind of a, if we look at a creation operator here that's appearing in the final state, it has to pair with some destruction operator somewhere. If it pairs with one of the ones in the initial state, that was kind of a line that didn't do anything in a graph, and so that was part of the disconnected process. If it pairs off with somebody in here, it's pairing off through a field because it's all local in the Lagrangian or in the operators. And so the Feynman rule was just the thing that multiplied A star or A in the field. And so we went through what those were. And the internal lines are ones where we're pairing off something appearing in these operators or appearing in the interaction Lagrangian. And so so something like a external line for a fermion was a u bar, came with a factor of u bar, the square root of labeled by some momentum and spin. So it's u bar of p sigma, 2 pi cubed times twice the energy. And then if we're doing it in position space, there'd be an e to the I px here, but in momentum space, that all gets Fourier transform away, so we just have this. And we have a photon line was a similar thing. It's labeled by some momentum and helicity, and that was given by epsilon mu star k lambda divided by the square root of 2 pi cubed times twice the energy. I'll call that omega k. And then an internal line, or an internal fermion line, if it's labeled by a Dirac, it's labeled by some momentum flowing through it, p, and Dirac, it's a Dirac matrix, so labeled by Dirac indices, and the matrix is, with my convention for these arrows, the matrix, you're running the indices along the opposite direction from the direction of fermion number flow. This corresponded to, there's always a factor of minus I over 2 pi to the fourth for any internal line. And then there's an integral over momenta. So normally you'd write it here. And then we have a minus I p slash plus m over p squared plus m squared minus I epsilon. And then there'd be an e to the I p x minus y, but when we've done the momentum integrals, those are all gone. And this combination is what I'll call S of p. So it's a matrix, the mn indices would be this p slash, remember, is P slash is just gamma mu P mu. So that's a gamma matrix. So there's an MN. Let me not use M because I'm using that for the mass. Let's say IJ. Be the IJ here. And then the photon propagator. Again, it's labeled by, in the same way that that's a matrix, photon propagator is a matrix in Lorentz space, so it's labeled by a mu and a nu. There'll be some momentum flowing through it, call it K. And so, or let's call it P again. And then this was given by minus I integral d4 k over 2 pi to the fourth. So those are the universal ones for the propagators. And then here we had a delta mu nu of k divided by k squared minus I epsilon. And delta mu nu in the gauge that I was using, which was not a covariant gauge, was eta mu nu. It was the sum of the polarizations that gave us this. And then there was something involving p's on one index or the other. And then I also had an n mu n nu term, which didn't have a p in it, which was the thing that systematically went through and canceled all the Coulomb Hamiltonians. And so I won't write it because we know that it's already done its job. Or if we derive this Feynman rules in a path integral, we never see it because then our interactions really are all going to be, when I write the interaction covariantly, I'm going to imagine that cancellation has been done. And so I would use in the path integral a covariant gauge, which I haven't described much yet. And of course, as soon as I said P, I wrote K, so let's just leave that as K. And there was a specific formula for what alpha was in the gauge I used, but it doesn't matter what that thing was. And the thing I want to do now is go through and show you why it doesn't matter. So I want to just basically show you why, in practice, that contribution in any of the graphs we're going to be drawing is always going to be zero. And so we don't need to keep track of it. And so it won't matter what alpha is if we're calculating things like this that are gauge invariant. So what I'm going to say will be true if these operators are gauge invariant and if these are physical states. So what happens? So let's show that. I want to show this. So the claim is the K mu alpha nu plus K nu alpha mu term always drops out of the answer, physical answer. You can ask non-physical questions where it doesn't drop out, but for the physical ones, it drops out. And so the question is, and I just want to show it to you by brute force in a graph. And then you'll see why it ties to the word identity, which is something that you prove in the assignment. So what's going to happen? If a typical graph, let's draw a graph. A Fermion line, if it comes in, Fermion lines will either go straight through the graph, and that might mean coming in and going back out where they started, or they come to you as loops somewhere. Let me just draw a graph that has examples of all those things. And then we could be connecting them up with photons in any way we like. So here's a graph. And so the issue is we want to take in a graph like this and take the P mu term from each of these photon lines and show that it's not contributing. So to do that, what we want to do is focus on one of these lines. So let's take any one of them. So you've got some sort of a Fermion line. So here's a random Fermion line. And it might be in secret one that closes on itself, or it might be in secret one that goes right out to the initial or final state. It doesn't matter yet. And there's going to be a bunch of photons attached to it. So let's say K1, K2, K3, Kn. And then we want to come along and say, I now want to attach the next photon to this, and I want to track the contribution of this term in that next photon. And the next photon, it can it could attach here, it could attach here, could attach here, could attach here, and there's a whole bunch of other things in between here. could attach here, could attach here. And so what we're going to have to do is sum over all of those things. And the claim is not that any one of them is zero, but when I sum over them all, I'm going to get zero. So just to be clear, these are not all there simultaneously. I'm going to have the sum over over graphs where I have a, I'll call this, not call it n, let's call it r, so kr mu. It'll attach here, 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 and we have to sum over all the options. This is just the one I'm imagining that this is in the graph already, and I'm going to take one more photon and attach it to this line, and I'm going to ask, does this piece of that next photon contribute? And I'm going to show you that when I sum it over all the places it could have gone in there, it's going to give the zero. So you can build from this an induction proof that in any graph this thing doesn't matter. And it'll be true for, it doesn't matter how many of these lines there were. I'm not going to use any of their properties apart from the fact that they exist.
Is that the R, like the K on the top left? That's an R.
That's an R. Yeah, this is the thing I'm summing over, and it's kind of it's a silly notation in the sense that I'm not summing over different momentum. I'm just summing over where it can go in.
Oh, okay. Okay, so basically you're fixing all the other momentums and you're moving the position of this.
Yeah, momentum. Right. And I'm fixing this momentum too. And I'm just going to ask as a function of, so this is something that depends on kr, k1, k2, k3, kn, and it's got a bunch of Lorentz labels, you know, mu1, mu2, mu1, mu2, mu3, and mun. And I'm just going to look at what that amplitude is summed over all the places where I could have inserted the kr. So let's just write that out. So there's going to be, you know, there may or may not be an external line here. So let me just leave that off. So there'll be a factor here, which is a possible external line. And I won't be explicit. When I need it, I'll put it back in. But it could also be that this is a loop, in which case there won't be an external line. What I'll instead do is I'll have to do a trace where the dangling direct label, you know, the dangling index I or J, I'll have to identify it with this guy and sum. That'll be taking a trace in Dirac matrix space. So that I'll worry about when I get there. But that's why I'm being coy about whether or not there's an initial or final wave function here. And there'll be a similar thing on the other end where the guy came in. And I should draw an arrow here. So I'm going to just write everything now after that. So I'm going to start off with a Dirac propagator here. And I should look at the momentum here. So let's say that there's momentum P coming in. Then this will be let's take the graph. So let me just take a representative one where I put it in the middle here somewhere. So imagine that this is KL and this is KL plus 1. And I'll imagine I'm putting the photon in between those two. So I'm going to get a whole bunch of stuff, which I won't write yet. The momenta coming through here, let's call this momentum, I don't know, P, and call this one here P tilde. And so that means that if the momentum coming in through here is K, then K comes in this way, and let's say P is going that way, let's say P tilde is going this way, so the P tilde here will have to be P minus K. Because momentum is going to be conserved in that vertex, yeah. Thank you. I was originally going to label it over there, but it's changed my mind halfway through here. Yeah. So this P is the definition of P. And I just want to focus on this part of it. So I'm going to get. So if I pick up the story for that propagator, I'm going to have minus I P minus K slash plus M over P minus K squared plus M squared minus I epsilon. And then we'll have the vertex here. So then that vertex, remember, was minus, I should write the Feynman rule for the vertex. So the basic vertex, it had an I, a 2 pi to the fourth, a delta function conserving momentum. So let's say that's K, P, and Q. Well, actually, I should always, let me just use always the same convention for way the way the momentum flows. Let's say that's P and that's Q. A plus P minus Q. And then there was a factor of, remember the Lagrangian, the interaction Lagrangian was, it was minus psi bar d slash psi, where this is a covariant d. Covariant d is partial minus I charge times A. So I'm going to get a minus times a minus is plus I times the charge. So this interaction thing will be plus I times the charge A mu psi bar gamma mu psi. And so that's int. So the Feynman rule here will have a factor of all the stuff that's not a field here. So we'll have a factor of I times Q. This Q is not a momentum. Let me just stick to electrons here. Let's say Q is minus E. So it's going to be minus I E. And that way I won't have to worry about I have minus I E times the gamma matrix mu I K, where this will be I, and this will be K, and this will be mu. So we'll have this factor, and the two pi's I'm not going to keep track of. I didn't keep track of these. I won't keep track of those. So I'll have a minus I times I is a just an E times gamma mu. And then I have now this propagator, which is has momentum P. So I'll have a minus I P slash plus M over P squared plus M squared. And then we'll have the other factors. And then possibly an internal line. Possible external line. Now that's the thing we had on the line, the Feynman rule for the propagator. We're trying to follow what happens to this. And in particular, I want to follow when it's always going to be true that the one of these k's is going to be contracted with a vertex in a graph like this. And so the k is always contracting with the gamma matrix. So I want to follow the k mu that came from the. So this k came from the from this term in this propagator. And I want to show you that that particular term is killing everything. And so that's why these things are dropping out. So that's why it was important to isolate that one of these guys had a k in it. And this should have been a mu. So there's for every index, it's always true there's a k on that index, and that's going to kill things. And for this one, that one won't kill it, but when this guy hits another index, that'll kill it. So it's sufficient to show you that these k's are killing the graph. Okay, so.
Sorry, where did that k come from? We had that gamma mu.
I'm focusing on this piece of this line. And I'm not following this because this actually will give you something in the answer. And I want to show you that whenever this k contracts on a fermion line, when you sum over that fermion line, you're going to get zero. And so that because of that, you don't need to keep this part in practice, unless you want to verify that cancellation happened. Here, let me make sure I don't launch off in the wrong direction. So the yeah.
So when you contract the photon line, so either K will be contracted or alpha will be contracted.
Right.
So when K is contracted, then it kills everything.
Yep.
But alpha contracts with the thing, so it won't kill.
So if alpha is being contracted here, it won't kill it. But then the K was contracted on something else, and then I'm going to make my argument for that line. So there's always a K, for this term that there's always a K that can hit something, and I'm just going to follow that K. And if it wasn't that one, it was that one. What's that? Yeah. Right, because this only appears on an internal photon line. Yeah.
So this is more of a technical question, but like in your interaction term, you have a factor of I, so I guess that's different of the convention I saw in my previous course.
Well, then your previous course was wrong. That's simple.
No, but like I'm just trying to figure out where the I comes from, because like you had the. Because like you have like your covariant derivative has an I in it, or doesn't it? Or
yeah, it does. It's the way you can check what decides that is so it's d mu psi is partial mu psi.
Yeah.
Minus I charge a mu psi.
Yeah, that's consistent with what I said in my previous course. So
right.
Now I'm guessing that the direct term doesn't have an I in front of the d slash, I guess.
The direct term. What's the direct term?
Like in the Lagrangian.
The Lagrangian. So L naught was.
Oh yeah, no, I think it doesn't.
L naught is minus psi bar d slash plus m.
Oh yeah. Okay, that answers my question.
And then there's some insane people in the world who will have a, so psi bar is psi dagger beta, which is I think I psi dagger gamma zero. And there's crazy people who don't write the I such that they'll put an I in here. And those people are just crazy, so you just ignore them.
I think these are the people who use the other signatures.
Yes, those are the people that we never talk about.
No, because like a.
I'm one of those crazy people.
Yeah, we've all sinned in our times, and that's fine as long as you repent and come back into the fold.
No, okay, I just have to learn the new convention.
That's the thing is that you know, at some level, choose your conventions, work out all these things once and for all, and then when you see anything else, never change your conventions again. Just if you read a paper and think they're trying to say this. So that would have meant they're trying to calculate this and then do that in your conventions and then see if it works and never try and reproduce anybody else's conventions because you waste way more time doing that than doing it from scratch and you learn more by doing it from scratch. And all I'm doing is I'm giving you these conventions where I've worked these, I've kind of debugged them in these conventions. And so if you want to debug your working through against what I'm telling you, then that's a check because it's been debugged for generations of physicists. and there are parallel, you know, examples of that for the wrong conventions, and so you can use those if you like. Getting it from a book is always dangerous because there's typos in books, and so anyway, everyone takes a choice, yeah.
Just to clarify, then, what is the convention? The French is the Fourier derivative doesn't have an I. It's absorbed into the gamma matrix.
Sorry, the covariant derivative, that I is the only one, yeah.
Partial derivative, partial slash.
Yeah, there's no I here, no.
Yeah, because normally I see I partial slash plus or minus
M. Yeah. Those people are crazy. I understand your repugnance, yeah, and your shock. Why were they doing that, you're saying? No, and what it's coming from is that depending on what your metric choice is, you know, gamma zero, what you're always designing, everybody's agreeing on this one convention, thank God, that this is twice the metric. So if you disagree on the sign of this, you're arguing whether or not all the spatial ones square to minus one and the time one squares to one, or the time one squares to minus one and the space one square to one. So I'm giving you the fewest squaring to minus ones in the choices I'm using, where this is minus plus plus plus. And so because of that, gamma zero is something which has, you know, it has imaginary eigenvalues. So the I here is just getting rid of that. And then once you've done that, then, you know, so you have some, so there's different people, depending on what they do, can put the I in here or not, because it doesn't matter for the purposes of Lorentz transformation properties. And then depending on what you do there and there, you may have it being appearing here.
Yeah. And that's why the denominator here is e squared plus m squared.
That's because of this metric, yeah, because that's saying that's minus e squared plus momentum squared.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Or just not use slashes.
If you like writing twice as long, yeah.
Gamma mu dvu is not that harder, right?
But if you have anything at all long, instead of writing one symbol, you're going to write two symbols. And the notation should be your friend. And every time you have to write something, you're introducing errors. So it's a very common notation. And so it's good to know it. All right, so now the thought is we're going to write that. So let's write k slash. In fact, we can write it as, let's write I k slash. I can write that as being as minus I p slash minus k slash plus m minus I p slash plus m, right? Because I've canceled everything except for this, and then this gives me an I k slash, which is that, right? So that's not complicated. And the point of doing that is that, and I probably didn't want to do minus I probably wanted a plus. But then I just have to have a minus I here. Right, that's a true statement. And the point of that is that this thing is the inverse of this thing, because, you know, if I take, for any for any p times minus I p slash plus m, you know, that's going to be difference of squares. It's going to be basically m squared minus, you know, I p slash squared. And I p slash squared, so that's, you know, it's plus p slash squared because the I squared is minus 1. And p slash squared is p mu, p nu, gamma mu, gamma nu. But this is symmetric under mu and nu, so I can replace this by 1 half its anticommutator. And 1 half the anticommutator is the metric, and so that's p squared. And so so that's showing you that the matrix part of this thing has gone away. And so this is now the unit matrix times p squared plus m squared. And so that factor, so if I take this factor, so if I take this and write it using this, then this factor I can take and multiply it by this, and I'm going to get it's going to give me the numerator this, and it's going to cancel that numerator. Or I can do it on this side. This guy will hit this guy, and it'll cancel that numerator. So it's kind of designed, so you see that the effect of this is to basically erase one of these guys. And so the bottom line for this little factor here was, let's just call this S. That's what I was calling it over there, was S of P. So what we had in the graph was S of P minus K times K slash, and I'll put in the minus I just to, or I'll leave out the minus I, times S of P. That was equal to, according to this, I'm going to have a plus I, and then this is basically the inverse of this matrix. So I'm going to get plus I S of, in fact, the thing I'm going to say, I don't need to, let me write one more line before I write the line I want to write here. So the upshot of this is I can write this as saying that K slash is equal to I, so I just brought that to the other side. And this is S inverse of P minus K, and this is S inverse of P. And so that's something which you'll recognize. What you proved in your homework is that if I take the expectation value, you know, of psi, current psi, and I write that as being u bar times something gamma mu of p prime of p and p. So that's proportional to that. Like, does this define some matrix? And then what you're showing in the assignment is that there's an identity that p mu, p minus p prime, acting on gamma mu of p prime p, is some number, which I forgot what it is because it depends on the signs here, but it's times the inverse propagator, or it can be written as, where this is the full propagator, not just the perturbative propagator. Is that? Yeah, in here somewhere there's I's and whatever. But the important thing is these factors. And this is this when we restrict to the simplest vertex, where it's just that. So if you take that and replace it by, you know, the Feynman rule, and take these guys and replace them by the propagators, then, you know, this statement here is this statement specialized to lowest order in perturbation theory. So the thing I'm using is essentially this. And so the utility of this is that the things I'm going to do now, you can prove, you know, very generally for a wide class of graphs as an exact statement using this. So this was the word identity we. And you saw that came from current conservation in the assignment. So that's what we're using here too. So because of that identity, you know, these inverses are basically canceling these S's. And so what we're going to get here is I times, so this guy will cancel this guy, and we'll just be left with S of P minus I of S of P minus K. So now you can kind of see that there's a recursive argument I'm going to be able to make, because what I've effectively what's happened is we had the factor in that thing up there, this factor turned into just another propagator or another propagator. And so as far if I repeat this argument now for a different, if I take the graph where I insert k somewhere else, all that's happened is that wherever I'm inserting it, I'm getting, for the Feynman rule of this line, I'm just getting a propagator again. And it's as if nothing happened there. And I've got some factor, which is one or minus one, depending which one I do. So the point in the if I take the whole graph, if I now do the sum over these insertions, so we sum over the insertion point, what I'm going to do is I'm going to get, so let's take, let me just take two examples and then as a physicist, I'll then work by induction from two. So let's take the case where I first stick it in here. This is P, this is P plus K, this is K, this is say K1, this is KL, AL plus one, AL plus two. So this would be P plus K minus KL plus one. And I'll add to that the same graph where we have KL plus one, L plus two, and we add it here now. So this is again P. If I match on correctly, this will be P plus KL plus one minus K. That's K. And this will be P plus KL plus one minus. Sorry, P minus, if the K's are going out, which is what I think I was doing here, maybe minus. This is P minus KL plus one. P. No, sorry. So this is P. This will be P minus KL plus one, because P that left. And this will be P minus KL plus one plus K. And then whatever. So if I add those two things, you can kind of see what's going to happen is that I'll get, the first one will give me a factor of, they'll have a big common factor that they're both going to share, which is all to the left of this point. And then the first one gives me, like, it gives me an S of P times the K slash. And I'm keeping track of the I's now, am I? I have EK slash. We had S of P plus K, and then we had the K. I won't worry about the factors of E. Then we have a KL plus one slash, if I don't need the bracket. Then we have a propagator for P plus K minus KL plus one. And then the same factor for the second graph will be S of P K slash L plus one, S of P minus K L plus one. Then we have the K slash, and we have the S of P minus K L plus one plus K. And then we have the other common factors. So that identity there, this one, is saying that I'm going to get, this is going to give me, so I'm going to first cancel the S of P. Sorry, I'm using the inverse version of it. So I'm going to get the S of, this will cancel, this will be proportional to S of P plus K, K slash L plus 1, S of P plus K minus K L plus one. That's this one. Then I'll have minus the same thing on the other side. So I'll have S of P. Now this guy will cancel. K slash L plus one. S of P plus K minus K L plus one. And then this guy will give me plus this guy is going to be the guy I cancel. So we'll have S of P K slash L plus one. Now this guy's canceled and I'm gonna just have S of P minus K L plus one plus K. And then we'll have minus the other one. So we'll have minus S of P K slash L plus one. This guy now cancels, so I'll have S of P minus K L plus one. And so you can see what's happened is that this guy cancels that guy. And then I'm left with these two guys. And so if we work our way out, the guy, the vertex that's in between that I've jumped over when I attached this line, that propagator is canceling out because on one side, the right-hand guy is canceling on the other side, the left-hand guy, because they have the opposite sign. So if I do that repeatedly, what'll happen is one of two things. If we look at a line, if the line was really in secret a loop, if I keep on doing that, eventually I come back and I get zero because I'm gonna, I'm canceling this vertex and I cancel the next vertex of the same identity. And then when I sum over them all, I eventually come back to the place where I'm back where I started. And then the last two, the things that we're not canceling were always the ones on the outside. So there I have an S in here, an S inverse here with opposite signs. And each time I use this identity, I move farther and farther out. And so eventually that S and that S inverse have the same momentum again, so they cancel at the end of the loop. So these will cancel when summed for a fermion loop. But what about in the case where it's a line that goes right through the graph? In that case, the only thing that'll survive is the last two, right? So eventually, I won't have a propagator here. I'll have the external line Feynman rule on both sides. And so what happens in that case, it's also zero, but for a different reason. So if the line, the fermion line, is not a loop, then what happens is that on either end, let's say on the far left, the Feynman rule on the far left was u bar of p if p was the external momentum coming into the line. So let's say it's p and it is now the external momentum. And now we're looking at the time when the photon is applied to the very first vertex. And so if we apply that here, what we would have had is, I'm just going to, instead of writing it this way, I'm going to write it that way. So we have a k slash times stuff. And so that'll be u bar of the left-hand guy will give me a factor of the I times the momentum on the left plus m. So this will be u bar of p, I, p slash plus m times stuff. And then they're minus the other term, but the other term is the one that cancels the other. Yeah, so this guy will cancel what happens when I attach it on this side. So that they were all canceling in turn. It's only the one on the outside that I have to worry about what happens to it. So this is the only guy I have to worry about. So this other stuff will be plus stuff that cancels. Although I have to come back to the other end, the other external line. And the point is that this is zero because the remember, that is the Dirac equation. The statement that d slash plus m on psi was zero was the same statement as saying that I p slash plus m on u is zero. Because that was, if we went to the rest frame of a spin down guy was that essentially, and that was equal to beta times itself, where beta was the matrix, zero, unit matrix zero. And in an arbitrary frame, that became this statement. So the external spinner is killing it because this is something which is being destroyed by the initial energy and the initial momentum being related by the Lorentz invariant expression. And the properties of the spinner is telling you that factor is zero. Same argument on the right-hand side is going to be the same. It'll be the same thing. We're going to get the inverse propagator on the right-hand side. So if we did the same thing for, if this was p here, we're talking about this guy, then we would have had the factor a bunch of stuff times k slash times u of p rather than u bar. And that's also going to be equal to stuff that cancels. Plus the piece which is I p slash plus m on u. And that'll be the thing that's equal to zero again. So the reason this is dying is different for the loop case and for the case where the line goes all the way through. It's either been killed by the properties of the initial and final external line, or it's been killed because when you go through the loop, all these propagator factors, they're never hitting something which is on shell, but they're all canceling each other because the loop forces them because it's cyclic, you never have somebody on the ends. Any questions about that? So that's long story there is that it just means that in practice, what do you do? You take your photon propagators and choose any gauge you like, make this as covariant as you like, but this is really the only guy that's contributing to anything physical in the end of the day. Provided that these Ward identities are true, which is really assuming that the current you coupled to was conserved, as you kind of saw explicitly when you derived it as the exact state. Yeah.
Alex had mentioned it. So that's the case where your gamma matrix is hitting your K.
Mm-hmm.
What happens in the case where the gamma hits the alpha?
So if the gamma hits the alpha, then the other end, the K hit a line? And make the argument on that line. Because I'm taking a graph and I'm focusing on one particular photon line. And so both ends attach to an electron line. And I'm going to make the argument for the end where, and it's true that each mu, so for one of these things, there's always one of these guys that's hitting a line. So I take the line that it hits. And this one will hit another line, but I don't care, because it's when I take this guy and sum it over its line, it's zero. Basically, that's the message, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Provided that things were gauge invariant. and when I'm about to do, yeah. So there's an order in which we do things. I think the next thing I'm gonna do, because it's a natural extension of this, is the infrared divergence story. And for the infrared divergence story, if you look at the soft part of the amplitude where you're looking at the things that are very sensitive to the longest wavelengths, you can check that if I take that thing, the part which involves the emission of a photon, it's also going to have a dangling index mu because the photon had to attach to it. If I take k mu and attach to it, you can explicitly see there that it's proportional. The answer is proportional to the difference of the charge in the final state and the charge in the initial state. So it's explicitly being tied to the fact that charge is conserved in that particular example, which is the zero momentum limit of conservation. This statement that p mu contracted with if this came from, this index was the index on the current, and the statement that the current satisfied its divergence was zero is what turned into the momentum contracted on this guy being zero. And if you take the limit where p prime and p go approach one another, so you're not transferring any momentum at all through the current, this becomes essentially the charge. And so what should happen is that for very, very small momenta, the requirement that the current be conserved should just be the requirement that the charge is balanced. And so I'm going to be able to show that explicitly is true because the point of the infrared story is that we focus on the infrared part, which is involving the smallest momentum transfers. And so if you just identify that by itself, it in particular satisfies these identities, and you can kind of see that the charge is balancing is what makes it all hang together. So current conservation is really just embedded in the bones of the whole story. Okay. Any questions about that? Probably a good place to switch gears. So I think I can keep some of these things and get rid of some of them. Okay, and this will be our last, and after this aside for the infrared divergences, we'll start evaluating a couple graphs, and that'll take us through dimensional regularization. And I want to do this first because part of the story of dimensional regularization is regulating, dimensional regularization will regulate both infrared and ultraviolet divergences all at once. And it's useful to be able to pick them apart, so I want to first talk about the fact that the infrared divergences were there. So. So the statement is that, you know, so in Feynman graphs, as we've seen, involve doing integrals over momenta, so momentum integrals. That diverge, that's the, and there's two ways in which they enter. So one is, each loop comes with an integral d4p over 2 pi to the fourth, as we said last class. Each loop also comes with a factor of, e squared over 16 pi squared. And second thing is, if we're calculating something like the rate for something, there's always a phase space integral. If some differential rate will be some amplitude squared that you'd calculate, the amplitude you calculate with some Feynman graph. There'll be some momentum conserving delta function, and then you'll have a bunch of d3p's. So let's say this is the rate for, alpha goes to beta. Then there'll be a sum over all the product over all the particles in beta of I element of beta. Let me write this so that you can actually see it. So it's product over all the particles in the final state of d3pn and other factors, but these are the ones I want to keep track of. So when you do the integral over these guys, they could also diverge. So these are these integrals converge, can diverge. But the way they diverge there's two kinds of divergences. So those are the ones that are coming from you're doing integrals from 0 to infinity. And so these are the ones that are the UV divergences, and these are the ones that are the IR divergences. And these guys never diverge in the UV, because when you're integrating over momenta, the energy conservation delta function stops you at some point. So you'll never get to infinity. So these are the phase space integrals. And these are the loop integrals. So loops can diverge, in the UV and the IR, whereas the phase space can only diverge in the IR. And that's because of energy conservation. You start giving up energy conservation, then all bets are off, because if I'm allowed to violate energy conservation, then I have some amplitude to produce something with arbitrarily high momentum, and there's a lot of space out there. So the integral over that might give you something of a problem, but you don't normally get that when energy is conserved. And so the story of the UV divergences is all about the loops. And that's the story, I kind of said this last class, but so what do you do with these things? When something's diverging, it's telling you that there's a problem with your calculation. So the moral, because quantum field theory is like a Middle Eastern religion, it's really cruel but fair. And so if you stray from the path, it'll punish you. It will smite you. But if you don't stray from the path, then there's rewards in heaven for you. So it's the moral here is that the UV divergences, they're all going to be local. So if you think of them in position space, they're all to do with bringing the fields together at the same space. It's kind of physically intuitive that if you have very, very, very large momenta, that's very, very, very short distances that are the problem. And so they can be absorbed into couplings or local interactions in L interaction, which is also local. And so the idea is that if you write down every possible interaction that you are allowed to do that's local, you will have a parameter there that will be available to absorb all the possible divergences you get at short distances. Because physically what these are saying is, and I hope to get to this before the term ends, but possibly not. Physically, this is just saying that nature has this property that you don't need to understand all the scales at once. There's many scales in nature. You don't need to understand them all at once. You can understand atomic physics perfectly well without understanding nuclear physics. But you have to understand some things about nuclear physics. You have to know the mass of the nucleus and the charge of the nucleus, but that's it, basically. And then you can understand atoms on their own terms. So short-distance physics tends to decouple from long-distance physics. But the precise statement of that is that there exist charges, there exist couplings in the long-distance theory. It's possible to choose the charges in the long-distance theory such that the details of the short-distance physics drops out. It's suppressed by 1 over the energy scale of that short-distance physics. But you have to choose the couplings correctly for that to happen. And if you don't choose them correctly, then this is going to force you to re-choose them. And so this expresses the fact that short distance physics decouples from long distance physics. And that's why it's good that field theory does this, because that's kind of why nature, that's why science is successful. You can isolate each problem on its own terms. Yeah.
So it's just similar to that, like a couple of concepts of query some dimensions, so that we can, some dimension of like, for instance, so that we can like change it across a distance.
Sometimes, yeah. So most of the coupling concepts will have dimension, like you say, and then the thing that you'll be changing them by will be something set by the dimensions of whatever the scale was that was contributing at short distances that you didn't know about. But some of them don't have dimensions, like the electromagnetic coupling here, for example, won't. But they can still logarithmically depend on those scales. And so in general, even for the dimensionless ones, this issue will arise. So this is hopefully we'll get to. But this is the one that typically you see in an introductory class. As soon as you do any kind of a loop, then you see these divergences. And so then you see that you have to have this cancellation happening. If we don't get to it again, the main message is that it always happens, and that, which just sounds like a surprise, because it sounds like most theories are not renormalizable, is what people say. There's a trivial sense in which everything's renormalizable. If you write every possible interaction, so there's an infinite number of interactions, so all possible powers of the fields and all possible powers of momenta, then you will always be able to renormalize your divergences, because that's just some random local thing consistent with your symmetries. And so any loops that are also consistent with the symmetries, well, anything local about them, which is what the divergences are in this case, they will agree with something one of your couplings. The subtle part is if you don't have an infinite number of interactions, we only had one interaction. Under what circumstances can you stop with just a finite number of the interactions? And the whole story there is if you work to some specific order in the energy of interest to you divided by the scale that you're not measuring to the n, let's say that, you know, you only have access to energies which are, 10% of the energies you're ignoring. And let's say you do an experiment which is accurate to, you want your predictions to be accurate to, 10 to the minus 3, one part per mil. Then that means you have to work to at least 3 powers of this in order to have that accuracy. So you want n to be 3. If you choose a fixed n, so you drop things that are smaller than any fixed power of E over m, then the statement is that there's only a finite number of things you'll ever have to renormalize to that accuracy. And then renormalizable theory in the traditional sense, like quantum electrodynamics, is a special case where n is equal to 0. So if you're going to completely ignore all the physics at higher energies, then the ones that are left that never have dimensions of inverse powers of mass, like the electric charge, which is dimensionless, they will be sufficient to keep track of all the divergences because you're ignoring all powers of E over m. And so the reason that renormalizable theories in that sense are everywhere in nature is because of this, those are just the situations where the short distance physics is actually completely irrelevant are the ones that will be renormalizable. So that's the fact that works for electromagnetism is not a surprise then. It's something which should be inevitable, that if we arrange for the heaviest, lightest charge to be heavy, then what's left should look renormalizable. So that'll be what we come back to that statement is what I want to head towards with the loops if we get there, but I think we're going to probably run out of time before we get there. But you have the statement of it. And I want to focus now on the infrared divergences because almost nobody ever talks about that in the introductory courses. This is actually a more general statement than that. It's really true that if you're doing lattice QCD or something and you're just on a computer diagonalizing everything, then the uncertainties you have there are local physics to do with the lattice. And if you go to the continuum limit, what happens is that all these statements apply in that case in the continuum limit. And in condensed matter physics, the same thing where you really do have a lattice. It's true that as soon as you have a hierarchy of scales, so as soon as you have something that's small, two physical things that are very different that you can take a ratio of, then the statement applies. And the thing where perturbation theory comes in, where you assign, if I say that, you know, when I was doing the power counting of the graph and I told you how it goes, like each loop goes like e squared over 16 pi squared, and there was a statement about how it diverged, that statement was a dimensional analysis argument. And if I just use the naive dimensional analysis of the fields, that's a perturbative statement. But if I had a strongly coupled theory and I kept track of the anomalous dimensions, so I just calculated how every operator scales, then the argument would go through with the correct scaling dimension. So it's this part of it is not perturbative, but in practice, when people are using it and they're making an assumption about how operators scale, then they could be using perturbation theory depending on how they decided how it scaled. So in particular, when I said that the dimension of a fermion was mass to the 3/2, and I said that the dimension of a photon field was mass, I was really using the Lagrangian what I did was I said the Lagrangian had to be dimension mass to the 4th because the action was dimensionless and it was integral d4x of this. And so I'm assuming in the path integral that I've got a saddle point where this is dominating when I make the scaling argument there. But if you had had some other different way of doing the path integral, then you could figure out what the scaling was that was relevant there. So this is coming from this, which is coming from perturbation theory. But that's the part. It's only really that power that is important there. Okay. So now for infrared divergences, the unusual thing is we have to worry about these guys and these guys. And the story I'm going to tell is that they cancel each other. So that we're going to take a general graph and identify how it diverges, how these guys diverge, and then we'll take a general, a different class of graphs that is related, and show how they diverge. And then the interesting thing is that they, when you add them together, they cancel. And that's the general message there. The moral of this ultraviolet story was things get renormalized. That's not the moral of the infrared divergences. The infrared divergences is saying that if you didn't have both these graphs, then you're just wrong. You're calculating something you can't measure, and so. The infrared divergences are really telling you just made a mistake. Think through what you did, tried to calculate, because what you tried to calculate didn't make sense. So for IR divergences, the thing you tried to compute didn't make sense. So start again. After rethinking. That's what the moral will be. And in this particular case, the moral will happen that the problem's coming for very, very, very slow momentum processes. And so the moral in quantum electrodynamics specifically will be that if you ask for a process with a specific number of photons in the final state, that's really not a physical question, because all you can really do in practice is say, I have specific kinds of numbers of photons where I've measured their accuracy to some non-zero uncertainty. And in particular, the ones with zero energy could be there with that same uncertainty. And so there could be a lot of photons in there that have energy less than my energy measuring threshold. And you're really obliged to sum over those. And it's that sum which is the one that's canceling this divergence. And the theory is punishing you for trying to ask a question that you can't answer, which is what's the amplitude of having exactly 6 photons and none that have arbitrarily small energy? And that's a question that you're not allowed to ask.
I have a question. So like,
which basically says that the couplings are enhanced, right?
I would say it's the same message in the sense that the way I would say what you said is true, but I would say that's it's kind of a through long use people have they've contracted the logic chain. But I would say that the real statement is that the your perturbation theory failed because it was diverging, and the reason it failed was the coupling that you thought you were perturbing in at low energies actually wasn't small. And if you kind of track systematically how big the coupling was, perturbation theory was actually a bad approximation. And so that was your mistake, was perturbation theory.
Oh, okay.
So it's always true that if you do a calculation where you have controlled all the theoretical error and it's a physical answer, it will never diverge in the infrared.
And that's true.
Yeah, and so that's, the question is, that then the interesting physical question is, why did it, what was the problem? In this case, the problem will be summing over soft photons is important. In condensed matter, it's sometimes true that, and it's also true in QCD, for example, that the coupling gets strong at low energies. But low energies, the physics is just different because things, it's not perturbative there. And so you can't see the protons. You can do perturbation theory at high energies, but the bound states, you will never see them in perturbation theory. And the theory is telling you that when you try and calculate things. Same thing for atoms, that if you look at the interactions of electron and a proton, they're perturbative at high energies, but when you come down to low energies, they become non-relativistic, and so the scaling changes, and so you're sensitive to different interactions depending on your kinematics, because the saddle point is changing essentially. And then at some point, when you get to the binding energy of a hydrogen atom, perturbation theory failed there, and you'll see that because the effect of coupling in the channel that has a hydrogen atom in it becomes strong, and that's the theory telling you stop using perturbation theory here. So this is important to have this distinction. And so when you calculate a graph and it's diverging in dimensional regularization and all you see is a pole, it's important to know how much of that was infrared, how much of it was ultraviolet, because what you do with them is different. So the first question is, which graphs diverge? So in QED, which graphs diverge in the infrared? And the answer is easy to state, and it's actually generic. Most graphs generically don't diverge in the infrared, and the reason for that is that everything's nice and smooth in the limit that the momentum. How do things diverge? If you have an infinite range of integration range, then you could have a perfectly bounded integrand and still have the answer diverge because it might be one or something, and you're integrating over an infinite range, and so you get something which is infinitely large. But if you're in some compact range, the way that you get divergences is that the integrand blew up somewhere because the range of integration was finite. And so what this is really asking, because we're interested in the zero end rather than infinity end, was we're asking. So here we're going to get trouble because things don't fall fast enough, but they're still falling. Here we're going to get trouble because things are going to start blowing up on us when the momentum gets small. So if you take some random graph, so let's take a graph, like I drew some before. Here's a random graph. The different, it's true that each momentum line, each photon line, looks like it's a potential problem because it's got a D4K. And divided by k squared. So the k squared is dangerous as k squared goes to zero because because the photon energy, here you're integrating over all k, so it's everybody's going to zero together. But by itself, that's not dangerous enough because you only got 2 powers of k here, but you've really got 4 powers of k in the numerator because that's really, if you thought of a polar coordinates, this is like k cubed dk, so the k cubed wins over the k squared. So by itself, the photon line is not dangerous. You need to have other dependencies on that momentum, any particular momentum, to make it dangerous enough. And so the rest of that dependence on k is in these lines it's attaching to. And so, we had examples of what. So if I take a particular one here, where that's p and that's p plus k, then if I just take that snapshot of that section, if I have of s of p, k slash S of p plus k times 1 over k squared minus I epsilon. So I'm just taking a piece of this graph coming from zooming in here. this thing you remember is that's minus I P slash plus M over P plus K, P squared plus M squared minus I epsilon K slash. Oh, we don't have a K slash, sorry. It's just it's a gamma mu, right? Because the K slash, those are the guys that all died. So we just have the gamma mu that the eta mu nu will hit. And we have a minus I P slash plus K slash plus M over P plus K squared plus M squared minus I epsilon. And then we have the 1 over K squared minus I epsilon. And you see that the, and we have an integral D4K. So if you look at the small k behavior, in order to get something dangerous enough, somebody in the denominator here has to also be singular in one of these other lines, and it's generically not singular, right? If k goes to zero, these things are perfectly normal, provided that p squared plus m squared is not zero. And so these are safe, provided p squared plus m squared is not close to zero. So the danger zone will be if a photon comes in and touches a line which wants to be on shell, so the one that wants to satisfy the p squared plus m squared is zero. So let's take an external line. So let's take it. So we have some complicated graph. I don't care what it is. And we just take one of the external lines with external momentum p, and we attach a photon there. Then what happens? Then let's say the amplitude without this external line was m. Let's say we have some initial state alpha, some final state beta. So let's say that the amplitude without that line was m alpha beta. Then I want to calculate how the rest of the amplitude, how this amplitude is related to that amplitude. So this will be something which, you know, I'll call this m mu of alpha goes to beta. And so it's going to be given by whatever we had before. Let's call that m alpha to beta. And the thing that's new is that this is now going to be a propagator, and we have that line, and we have that external line was there before. But we have a u bar of p times a gamma mu, the polarization vector epsilon mu. Actually, let's not even worry about that. Let me actually, since I want to do loops, let's do this one, right? Have those guys talk to each other. So then we'll have p here, we'll have q here. And this will be k. So this part of the graph will give me a factor of integral e4k over 2 pi to the fourth. Let me not even track the 2 pi to the fourth. That doesn't really matter. We have a 1 over k squared. And then these two propagators are going to be minus I. So if this is, let's say this is P coming out and Q coming out, and let's say K is going that way. We'll have so this momentum will have to be P plus K. Times stuff. And then we have also, so let's call this IJ. So I don't want you to think, the thing I'm going to write down next is not multiplying this. So it's going to be times, there's another piece with another direct indices on it, which will be, if this is k and that's q, then this has to be q minus k. So we'll have minus I q slash minus k slash and let's call it, say L R. And then we have the rest of the graph. And because we know that this is an external line, we know that p squared plus m squared is 0. That's equal to q squared plus m squared. And so that means that we can take this, we expand this out, this being p squared plus m squared, which is zero, and then what's left will be 2p dot k plus k squared. The same thing here. This will be the q squared plus m squared will be zero. We'll have a minus 2q dot k plus k squared. And so now you can see that we're in trouble because if k goes to zero, this denominator now is linear in k. This one is also linear in k. So here's a 1 over k squared. Here's another 1 over k squared. 1 over k to the fourth d4k, that will diverge. And so this should diverge logarithmically. So the k integral diverges like a log.
M squared is gone in both denominators.
Say that again?
M squared is gone in both denominators. It's still there for some reason. I think it was.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, that should be gone. Right. Yeah, because that was being canceled by the q squared and the p squared. Right. Thank you. And we can effectively, we can drop the k squared because it's subdominant as k goes to zero. The one that's really leading at small k is the linear piece. And so it's really the, these guys are going linearly with k. And so these are the guys of the problem. The infrared divergences are going to happen, but only when you connect two external lines. So that's kind of a little bit ambiguous. So if I draw this graph, for example, So there's no vertex here, but these lines are just crossing each other. So one question is, does that graph diverge in the infrared? Let's take a vote. Who thinks it does diverge in the infrared? Got one taker. Ashin, you're part of the vote too. So the question is, does this graph diverge in the infrared? And we've got one taker for yes.
For specific external choices, it will diverge.
Did you say that again? I didn't hear that.
For a specific external traces.
External traces.
What do you zero mean momentum. Oh, external zero momentum.
Let's take the external momentum to be on shell, but not special other than that. Just like over here. So there's no requirement that p goes to zero or anything. It's just on shell is all you have to ask. What's your vote? It put you on the spot.
No idea right now.
Okay.
Yeah. I should
calculate. Who votes that it does not diverge?
I would argue that it doesn't because no external legs are actually.
Yeah, that would be a logical way of reading what I told you, right? Who else? Who's on his side? Yeah, no one's really sure because it sounds like a trap, right? And it is a trap. You're wrong. And it's subtle because there's a sense in which it doesn't diverge because it looks like there's an internal. So the issue is you have to be precise about what you meant by soft and hard. So the statement is, so when I say that the thing that diverges is when you're connecting external lines, what counts is whether or not these photons are these photons all the limit. There's two limits here, right? There's this photon and this photon had different momenta. And the question is really not sufficiently precise. The question is, if I take k1 to zero and the other k to be not special, will that diverge? Or take k2 to zero, or when I take them both to zero together, do they diverge? And the statement is that you're right for the case where you take one to zero or the other one to zero, but not both. And you're right in the case you take them both to zero. Because if you take them both to zero, then they're both soft. And then the graph you should be thinking about is the one without any photons. And then those are external lines. And so the criterion is true, but sometimes you have to think about it a little bit as to what you meant by what was the graph without the photons in it. And so your choice was the graph without the photons was the one without these loops altogether, and your choice was one of the ones with the photons was part of the thing that I started with, and then I added the last one. And the conclusion you get is true in both cases, but then you're talking about different limits because your case is where both limits are going to zero, and the other one is where they're going to zero separately.
Just qualitatively.
Well, that's not connected though. That'll be if I look at a thing like that where I emit a soft photon, those will be a class of graphs I have to also talk about, and they will also diverge. And so then the soft photon thing will be the story. Do I have to include those?
Sure, but you know, just thinking about connected ones, like I have
curves off connected photons, like graph.
But you're not measuring these guys, right? These are all just virtual things. The guys you're measuring are the guys that come out one end or go in the other end.
Right, but just like qualitatively, that's going to have, it just seems like that thing's going to sort of diverge and try to figure out what the average is.
Well, you're going to be right in the sense that if I ask a question where I say I don't know how many photons there were, but I do know that I only had things that are above or below a certain energy, then that will force me to add the square of this graph to the square of the graph where I start emitting some soft photons, and then the sum of those squares will be the rate I'm interested in. And it'll be true that that will be the infrared finite thing. But if I just ask the math question of, I take a fixed number of external lines, and I just ask, does that graph diverge? Then I don't have to ask the question of what the final states were I was summing over. And that the mathematical question, the statement, the answer is the statement that it's going to diverge when you connect external lines, and these subtle ones where you've got overlapping divergences is to do with exactly what limit you meant by the infrared limit. All right, so where I'm heading is there will be a statement. I want to be able to isolate the divergent part of this graph efficiently. And I want to show you that it factorizes, that there's basically a divergent factor times the rest, which is some complicated thing. And when we look at the emission of soft photons, they're also going to factorize, where it'll be some divergent thing in the phase space integral times the rest. And the rest will be the same rest. And so then there will be the reason that there's a chance for there to be a cancellation is that those common factors in the rest of the graph will be the same common factors. And the trick will be in identifying the divergent part of both the external emission and the soft exchange and showing that those factors are combining in a way which has the same coefficient. That's what it's going to come down to. Yeah.
So you said that like in the second graph, in the limit, this thing becomes just like a vertex, then it diverges, right? Like just a vertex with external photons.
I mean, if I take that.
Basically, taking all k1 and k2.
Yeah. If I said that this was the hard graph I did. So supposing I take I think of the process as being I only integrate over momenta that are bigger than some very small cutoff, and that's what I mean by the hard part. Then I'm going to add a bunch of soft photons to it. If I took this to be the hard graph, and I said I'm now dressing it with both of these being soft photons, that diverges when this goes like d8k for each of them over k to the eighth. If you it's actually a good exercise to work that through. Same argument as I did. But if you thought that this was the graph that was the hard graph, and I added a soft one like that, that would not diverge.
Yeah.
Okay, so in the remaining 5 minutes, let me see if I can get to the factorization argument. So you can kind of see that in each case here, it looks like a mess because there's a lot of gamma matrices going on. But if I'm only interested in the small k limit, then you can see that I can really ignore this. And I can ignore this. And so in practice, those propagators are turning into things that are not that bad. So what we have is we've got the minus I. If I keep the pieces that survive at low k, it's the minus I p slash. You know, in the graph, I also have the external line here, right? U bar. So I'll have U bar P, and I'm going to focus on this factor here. I have minus I P slash plus M plus stuff which is order K, which I'm going to think is subdominant, because D4K over K to the fourth is just diverging. So any powers of K in the numerator are going to make it converge. And then I have in the bottom, I've got 2K dot P. Minus I epsilon times a bunch of stuff. This is the thing that's dangerous from that line. And then there's a similar factor coming from this line, which I could also keep track of if I wanted to. But let's first do this one. So the thing is that what's nice here is that, where's the gamma matrix? The gamma matrix appeared to the left, right? So I have really U bar of P gamma mu, because that's from the vertex. And then that'll be contracted with the propagator that takes me to the other line. So what we used before was that U bar of P times I P slash plus M, that's zero. So if I could get this guy to the other side of the gamma matrix, I would have a chance of making it go away. And so we need to the M, of course, goes by because it's this unit matrix, but the P slash has to get by the gamma mu. So if I take gamma mu P slash, that's really, you know, P lambda gamma mu gamma lambda. And I can take P, I can always write the product of two things as being the sum of their anti-commutator and their commutator, right? So I can write that as 1/2 the anti-commutator of gamma mu. Or actually, let me write it as being the opposite order. What I know is that, I'm probably saying this in a stupid way. I know that the anti-commutator is twice the metric, right? So what I'll do, that says that gamma mu, gamma nu plus gamma nu, gamma mu is twice the metric. So I'm going to use this to solve for, I'm going to write this as minus gamma lambda gamma mu plus twice a to mu nu, a to mu lambda. So that's minus p slash gamma mu plus 2p mu. And so the nice thing is that that means that u bar of p gamma mu minus I p slash plus m is equal to u bar of p times I p slash plus m gamma mu plus 2p mu. And then that's zero because IP slash plus M kills the U bar. And that worked because I was always on an external line because those are the ones that were infrared diverging. So in practice, the only thing that each of these factors, the gamma matrices are kind of a distraction. This is really U bar of P times twice, twice P mu divided by 2 K dot P minus I epsilon. And I can just cancel the twos and divide this epsilon by 2 and call that the new epsilon. Times the rest of the graph. And the same thing is true for this factor, that I'll have there'll be a factor which will be u bar of q times twice q mu, or q nu, I guess, right, k dot q minus I epsilon times the rest. And then these things all combine into something. And so the thing where I'll stop now is that the important part is that the thing that's dangerous for small momentum is always the gamma matrices go away, essentially, because the thing that's singular is something, because these guys are on shell, external lines on shell, is something which has got no gamma matrix indices here. So I can take these factors that came in for different lines and I pull them out as a common factor for the whole graph and the rest of the graph. The fact that these are gamma matrices won't matter for this infrared divergent part. So I can write the punchline is that M mu alpha to beta is equal to 2 p mu over, sorry, p mu over k dot p minus I epsilon. I should do, then there's a q nu over k dot p minus I epsilon. Then there's the photon propagator that connected them, so I should give myself some space here. Times a to mu nu times m for alpha goes to beta without that extra graph factor plus non-singular, or not IR singular. So this fact that you got that a divergent thing times the rest is called factorization. And an important thing for this whole story is that that's going to be true for these loops. It's going to be true for the emission of the photons, that there's a factor that's kind of a diverging and there's another factor which is not diverging. So you can handle that divergent factor kind of on its own.
I think there's one over k
squared. Yes, thank you.
And then there's k dot q
there. And that's q, right. Thank you. That's a good place to stop. So the rest of the story is we're going to basically do this. And now we have to ask, what happens if we do this for six lines at a time? I have to add all those things up. There'll be some sum over all the possible ways we can connect these lines. And that'll basically, what's going to happen is that's going to exponentiate this thing. So we're going to get a sum of things that are all powers which is going to, and because they're all factorizing, we're going to get this thing going along for the ride, and then there's going to be an exponential of this thing appearing in the, when we summed over all possible ways we could be drawing these lines. And that exponential is what we're going to compare to the sum over all possible ways of it putting external emission lines on initial and final states. So we'll see you guys at 2:30.